and welcome to the House Einstein podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to have a fantastic show. I am Osman with House Einstein, and I am the founder of The Brokerage and also a realtor here in Boulder, Colorado.
Hello, hello. I'm Hamish Crabb, and for this podcast, I'm the producer. I also help keep The Brokerage run smoothly, take care of a lot of the marketing tasks, and assist with contracts as necessary, and showings.
And all sorts of other random things that real estate people on. Do.
Yeah. I mean, keep it short, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the unique thing about the real estate profession is that we often find ourselves doing things because they just need to get done and there's nobody else to do them. So we just take care of them because it just has to happen. Our mission at House Einstein and in this podcast is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. And as a mild disclaimer, if you are a House Einstein client, please call us for advice or send us an email. Reach out to your House Einstein agent. Otherwise, this podcast is just entertainment. We are here to entertain you, maybe educate you a little along the way, but we are not your real estate advisors, and we're not going to give you much relationship or spiritual advice either, and you should disregard all advice, actually, that we give you in this podcast. Don't believe anything we say. But if you are a client, just call us. That's what we're here for. We are here to help you more than anyone else.
Same with if you'd like to be a client.
True. If you'd like to be a client, the best way to reach us is just to call us. And you can find us at houseeinstein.com. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter. You will find that at houseeinstein.com. You will find content there you won't find anywhere else, including discussion of active listings, which we can't talk about anywhere else. That newsletter is for clients. It's for prospective clients. I know a bunch of other realtors are subscribing to it too, and that's fine. But who it's intended to is a very select audience that has to opt in. And there are all sorts of reasons we can't talk about active listings, but we won't go into that in this intro.
No. But today we have a decent amount of topics lined up. We're looking at our market conditions, what to kind of expect for the spring, percentage of listings under contract. We're also going to take a look at the sale of a week, and usually we cover some higher end homes. This one's a little different, and we'll get into that. We also take a look at a few local news items as well. There's a little bit more in there, but we'll wait until we get there.
Yep. Those are the essentials of what will be in this podcast. And let's get into it.
Fantastic.
So, welcome to March. By the time you hear this, it should be March 2nd.
First.
March 1st. It depends on how fast you get it produced, Hamish.
But Fridays.
Oh, right. It's a leap day. It's a leap year. That's
right. Okay. Oh, yeah. You forgot. Yeah.
I forgot it's a leap year. So you should expect to hear this on March 1st or the first weekend of March. And that really is the kickoff to the spring season, in my opinion. That's when things really start to get going. Expect to see quite a few new listings this week because that's what everyone's been waiting for. A little warmer weather, a little bit more activity. More buyers are now entering the market. There's a seasonality to the real estate market everywhere. But here in Colorado, it really on the Front Range, anywhere from South Denver suburbs all the way to Fort Collins is our footprint. Plus, we do some mountain properties, some stuff in the resorts. You really start to see stuff wake up. The resorts have a little micro mud season that is sort of dead, by the way. Remember last year with our listing in Breck, the mud season was really kind of a surprise how few people are there for mud season. But that's still a ways away. In the meantime, what I would say to our clients who are asking us, well, Osman, what's the best strategy? How do I think about this market, especially given the run-up in prices that have happened during the pandemic, the fact that prices in some markets are collapsing while other markets are seeing crazy bidding wars? Meanwhile, I keep hearing all this bad news about commercial real estate. How do I think about this as a buyer and a seller? Is there downside risk to a seller holding off? Is there upside risk for a buyer holding off? Like, when is the right time? And in the newsletter this month, I wrote that for at least a decade, the challenge has not been pricing with homes. The challenge has been finding a home actually worth buying at all. That there are so many unattractive properties from both an investment perspective and a long-term livability perspective that often buyers find themselves really frustrated with the Colorado market because there's so little available in their given price range, and their mindset is level set from another market where $500,000 might buy a mansion, and here $500,000 is entry level at best, and that's not in the city of Boulder. That's outside the city of Boulder and outside the core areas. So, the median sale price is well over $1 million for a single family house in Boulder, in the city of Boulder. And what you get for that is just incredibly disappointing to a lot of people, especially if they're coming from outside the area. And often sellers aren't willing to do any updates, fix any issues. So the ones that are really turnkey, that the sellers have put time and energy into, sell much faster. And this dynamic is really frustrating. So I sympathize with those buyers who are struggling to find something worth buying. And that's been the biggest challenge. And the good news is that this market has a lot of selection right now. As of today, as of 5 minutes ago, we just did a quick at back of the envelope, what percentage of homes are under contract? Only 40%, 39.7% of listings, that's the combination of attached and detached, so all townhomes, condos, and single-family houses, only 39.7% are under contract. 60% are available for buyers to put an offer on. And compared to during the pandemic, it might have been 30% of listings actually are available, and they're often available for 48 hours before they're gone. So selection right now, put that lens on your framework, selection right now is fantastic. It's been, it's probably the best it's been in at least 7 years, and maybe the full decade. It has been really, really hard to find anything worth buying, and now you have selection. So what I would advise, or at least you have better selection, it still sucks, it just sucks less. It is not a buyer's market.
Slightly more of the pie, yeah.
It sucks less. So the thing to think about is that pricing is really sticky on the downside. And if I didn't understand this market and having had worked in it for 20 years, I would think, well, prices are just going to drop very quickly, and I'll have both selection and great pricing. And it just doesn't work that way, because sellers will just not sell, especially in markets where they're really well qualified. They put plenty of equity in. The job market's really, really strong. So I guess there's tech layoffs that have happened, and including some of our clients. That's a big deal. But as a whole, the percentage of tech workers, I think they're sort of the marginal. Like they may have helped drive pricing up faster, but I don't think it's going to have much effect on the downside swing other than to continue to increase selection. So the way I would think about it is, now's a good time to lock in a really attractive home. Don't expect to get a great discount on it. And as interest rates drop, which they almost certainly will at some point, I don't know when that will happen. It just has to happen given our national debt. There's no doubt in an election year, it might happen sooner than we think. I've been saying this for a lot longer than I would like, but it has to happen. Yeah. And at that point, you refi yourself into a much lower monthly payment. Getting the property that really works for you, your family, your loved ones, the right location, that matters so much more than a couple of percentage points on the interest rate. And yes, I understand there's a huge difference between a 4% mortgage and a 6.5% mortgage or a 7% mortgage in terms of a monthly payment. But the reality is, so few of the city of Boulder buyers are monthly payment driven. It's almost irrelevant. They're looking at the stock market. So take advantage of the inventory if you have it. And if you're looking for an agent to help you look at homes and think about this from a critical perspective on selection, that's what we do. Our mission is to help you be smart about real estate. We have a number of agents on the team. I'm happy to help you personally. Find us at HouseEinstein.com. But that's the strategy I would pursue on the buy side, is absolutely take advantage of selection, but with patience, with a strategy that is willing to let less than optimal homes go, but with a strategy that's very aggressive when the right house appears for the right price point where it's priced right. I would not sit on the sidelines and I would not try to negotiate really aggressively on price once you find the right house. If it's not the right house, well, maybe you're trying to negotiate on a stale listing and we're going to try to get you a really big discount from list with the idea that you're going to improve it over time. You're going to invest in remodeling and renovating. And then the best location really matters and the best bones really matter. And the price point at that point really matters, because you want to invest a budget into renovation. That's the approach I would take. Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting, because most people don't want to do renovations. They would much rather buy it turnkey, and those homes sell for a premium and they sell faster. And this is what we'll segue to, Hamish, is why we're giving all of our sellers so much time and advice this year, why we're meeting with them, is because if you're on the sell side, you should do what you can to improve the marketability of the home, even more so than you've done in past years by mm-hmm. far, because you have more competition. But within that competition, you know, that slice of competition, there's a sub-slice of homes that have been updated. And if you have a home that might be at a busier location, or maybe doesn't have the best layout, or whatever, it's something is somewhat less than attractive, you should spend some money in updating kitchens and baths and fixing paint and staging the house. It will help it sell so much faster because of how few homes are like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It becomes more compelling, especially if the buyers have, you know, you bring up this example a few times, but if the buyer's been on 5 showings that day and your house is the last one on the block and it looks, you know, tenfold better than the competition, works out, right?
I've been in those meetings, Hamish, with those buyers.
Yeah.
And we'll go into a house and we've seen 20 other homes, and all of them have been disappointing. And suddenly you see one that you can imagine yourself living in. It is not cluttered. It is not dirty. Every windowsill has been deeply cleaned. All the window tracks have been cleaned. The paint has been updated to current colors. The kitchens and bathrooms have been updated. The lighting, you don't have those really ugly nipple lights or whatever they're calling them on the ceiling. Like, you've spent, and they're so cheap to update lighting. You spend a few $1,000 prepping the home. Kitchens obviously are not cheap. Bathrooms are not cheap. But depending on price point, even those sometimes are worth a 6-figure investment, particularly on the high end here in Boulder. Mm. I mean, you spend $150,000 on a really gorgeous kitchen remodel. Maybe you remodel the powder room too, so the first floor, the main level, is really fetching. I've seen that $150,000 turn into a $500,000 increase in value.
Wow.
Those buyers at that end, you know, the 3+ million range, they really value their time. And they're moving into a bigger home, or more likely they're coming into this market for the first time, and they need to get their family here. They don't want to monkey around with kitchen remodels and bathroom remodels. They're moving in 3 weeks or mm-hmm. 3 months, and they need that house dialed in.
Spick and spam.
Yeah. They're flying here 3 times, and in those 3 times, they're going to make their purchase decision. And that's why 150 turns into 500 upside. 150 invested can easily turn into 500 upside on the 3+ market.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
preparation goes a long way, and that's, you know, we're seeing more inventory out. There's also the conversation of golden handcuffs, as the terminology I've used coined, and it's the idea that the sellers are more unwilling to sell because they have fantastic interest rates compared to what you can get now. But yeah, with that, and the sellers that are selling, either they have to, job location, you know, change of life status, something like that. All this inventory, more competition, and you just have to get more competitive with it. And that, I mean, shameless plug, this is our podcast, but important and competent marketing is a big factor of that as well. Communicating the actual selling points of the home and why it makes sense for any particular buyer is really important, especially now.
Yeah. Well, one of our colleagues actually posted something very similar on her social media, that she'd been hired to tell the house's story.
Mm.
And the more unique the home it is, the more unique the home, the more important it is to get the story right. Because it probably doesn't appeal to all buyers. And it's at a price range where it's really selective, right? People have the ability to, like, there. So this is a marketing reality check for real estate. The further up you go in price, the more flexible buyers are in price. That's called price elasticity in economics.
Hmm.
If I'm thinking right, is it price elasticity of demand? I think that's right. And the higher up in price it goes, the wider that elasticity. So somebody that's going to spend up to $4 million could also buy anywhere between 2 and 4, right?
Right.
But somebody that's spending $600 to $800, that $200,000, that's it. That's like tapped out. And For the upper end, they're reallocating capital from other investments. They're thinking about this really differently than somebody that's thinking about a monthly payment. Mm-hmm. And so that's important to keep in mind, and also why we would, at this point, and you're not quite too late, but you're getting close if you're going to renovate your house prior to listing. It's March. Yeah. If you're going to time seasonality, you want it under contract by at the latest mid-July. So that gives you a couple of months' time, and in most cases, the best contractors are not available for instant work, so you're going to be dealing with the B team. And getting it done quickly is challenging, but you should really be on market by, I don't know, early May. You've got 2 months to not screw this up.
And I'm going to hit on this one more time. Selecting an agent that knows their stuff and has decades of experience will be able to guide you on the updates that are worth it and the updates that aren't. HouseSignSign.com.
But there's other agents too, and we're not the only game in town, so I do want to mention that, that whoever you choose, whether it's us or somebody else, make sure that you're getting advice on how to properly prepare your home for sale. You want to ask questions about how they're actually marketing this beyond the MLS, and if they start talking about how they're number one and sell more homes than anybody, that's nonsense. Don't buy into that. You want to ask what they're actually doing for you in terms of improving your home for sale, managing the listing once it's active, marketing it professionally, and also pushing that marketing. Don't just stick it on the MLS. You need to actually pay for distribution. And if they can't talk about that, if they can't talk about that intelligently, then you're probably dealing with somebody who, I mean, maybe they sell a lot of homes, but it's not necessarily in your best interest. You may be leaving a lot of money on the table and maybe a lot of time on the table to deal with a high volume agent that is slick in their personal marketing, but actually is not providing a lot of service to you as an individual seller.
Yeah.
And if you're looking to interview us, you'll find us at HouseEinstein.com. All right, let's move on, Hamish. Let's talk about a home that I think illustrates exactly that type of buyer that is coming to this market and needs the home that fits the budget but also fits their lifestyle. And they don't have time for renovations. And so they're looking for something relatively turnkey in a relatively safe location that, you know, wasn't built in the 1950s and then not updated for 30 years. The last updates were the 80s or 90s. They're ready for a house that they're going to live in immediately. So this sale of the week, is 4840 6th Street. So go to realtor.com or Zillow if you have to. I'm not a fan of Zillow, but you can go to Zillow and you can pull this listing up. We'll also provide a link in the show notes.
Absolutely.
And this house, built in 2002 in the subdivision called Cary, which nobody's going to know what that is because everyone refers to this area north of Lee Hill and west of Broadway as Dakota Ridge. And Dakota Ridge, where the residential side of Dakota Ridge anyway, there's also a whole commercial area that includes the homeless shelter, used to include a strip club, still includes the bus stop on the north end of Broadway.
That area, still there?
The strip club's gone. The bus stop is still there. The homeless shelter is still there. There's a bunch of other industrial use. And all of that's going to keep changing over the next 20 years. It makes no sense for some of the most valuable real estate in Boulder County to be used in that way. Although I love having those jobs and that diversity here. We're going to start seeing the North Boulder Arts District come into fruition, which is just south of this location we're talking about. So I like this stuff being there, but I think its days are numbered. Don't take my prediction for what's going to happen to be what I want to happen. But anyway, back to this house. So house was built in 2002 in Cary, the Cary subdivision, which is, in my opinion, part of Dakota Ridge, and everyone's going
to
think about that.
I think we're safe to say, refer to it as Dakota Ridge here out.
Yeah. People like this location. In fact, we did a whole video, and we should put a link in the show notes to that. A couple of years ago, I did a whole video about Dakota Ridge, the pros and cons, what you need to know about Dakota Ridge. But it's a newer neighborhood, right? So these homes are way more functional in their design. They feel like a more modern home. I mean, compare a 70s or 80s era car to one built in the early 2000s. It just, the design is much more in line with what people are looking for today. The ceilings are tall. The kitchen and floor plan flow into each other. The open floor plan on the main. The bedrooms are primarily on the upper level. And there's a couple of bedrooms in the basement. It's 5,000 square feet, or just under 5,000, which is plenty of room for most families. And it has a two-car attached garage. I mean, this house represents, I would say straight up the fairway for what
very down buyers, the line. Yeah.
Yeah, for if you're going to draw you know, if you're going to say, okay, what do most buyers want? This is what most buyers who especially if they have a family, this is what most buyers want. And the home itself is not particularly remarkable otherwise, right? And when you look at the photos of it, it has what probably is an EIFS exterior, and I don't know that for sure, but when I look at the window trim that is wrapped in, it has like a design around the trim. You see, like, it doesn't have wood trim. It has trim that looks like it's in the stucco.
Yeah.
That is very likely to be EIFS. And there's only one way to tell, and that's a test. And EIFS isn't the worst thing in the world. EIFS can be great.
Actually, it's just an additional layer of due diligence, really. You know?
It's something to know, yeah, and something to do an inspection on. It has a nice clay tile roof, which in theory should be protective from hail damage. It, I don't know about that green door, but it has a nice entryway,
is
floors,
is terracotta
vaulted ceilings.
A brand of the clay roof, or is that more?
I don't think so, Hamish. Okay. Terracotta is just that style of clay roof is usually referred to as terracotta.
Gotcha.
I don't think it's definitely not a brand.
Okay.
It's just a clay roof in that style is referred to as terracotta, but vaulted ceilings and a nice flowing, you know, family house. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, this is a house that if you had guests and your friends and your kids have their friends over, you could have everyone over and hanging out in the kitchen, hanging out in the dining area and entertain, mm-hmm, and also function well on a day-to-day basis. If you've got these kids running around, especially with the breakfast bar as part of the kitchen. And then the home also has an office, which most people want, a home office. But nothing in the interior is like mind-blowing in terms of its finishes. A lot of it is still builder grade.
I do like the whimsy, I'll call it, of the three-tap upstairs bathroom. If you scroll down in the photos, it's like a...
Oh, yeah, almost, that's definitely, yeah, not builder. I wouldn't expect that to be original builder installed. Mm-hmm. That's pretty neat.
So there's, I mean, there's, sure, touches of character, right? And you're going to expect to see that. You might not. I take that back. But yeah, sometimes you get some cool little additions.
The second floor bathroom in the green and white dots, that's pretty cool. It's got some pops of color. I'm not saying it's a horrible house. I'm just saying,
no,
it's not like, for $2+ million, it's not a home that's going to wow you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a home that is going to work for you, and you're not going to be embarrassed to have your boss over for dinner. Right, it's got a little home gym in the basement, little bar area. Now, the thing about Dakota Ridge is it's the land of large homes on small lots.
Hmm.
And unless you're the spider guy that owns a giant parcel in here, you're dealing with very little backyard. But for $2.5 million, it's or 2.3, it's a large home, decent sized lot, 7,000. So it's not as tiny as the lots in Newlands. And this equivalent house in Newlands, I mean, add 1.3,
yeah,
1.4, easy.
Easy.
If you could even find it, because they restricted homes of this size in Newlands, you're more likely to find it on Juniper and Kalmia, one like it. It won't be a builder-grade house like this, but it will be, and by that I mean there was a design company, right? They came in and they came up with 5 models. All those models went through focus groups, went through architects, and they came up with a design that appeals to the masses. You won't see that in Newlands, and you won't see that in Kalmia and Juniper, but you will see it in Dakota Ridge. So it's like, I don't know, the Honda Accord design study house. Like, it works.
Yeah. Right?
Most people are going to say this is fine.
What is it?
For a rental car.
Road tested, you know, proven the time of trial, or you know the phrase. Either way.
It's a house... It's just not an exciting house unless you've been looking at all of the other unattractive homes in this price range, and suddenly you might get excited by this. But in any other market where there's, well, in many other markets where there's a lot more supply, this might excite you, but or this would not excite you at all. But here in Boulder, given how few turnkey houses there are, that's only 23 years old, you might think of this as a bargain.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're also really close to open space. You're also really close to the cycling routes. You can buzz downtown very quickly, right on Broadway. You can be in downtown in 10 minutes. It just makes sense. So let's talk about the deal itself.
Yeah.
Home was listed as coming soon. literally right before the new year, which I really don't know why you would list a home on like right before New Year's Eve unless you're trying to not let the whole market see it. I don't know. Maybe they were just ready to go. But it actually went active 6 days later. So coming soon for a week and then active on January 6th. And it was available for about 20 days. Looks like 19 days total. So a little over 2 weeks. And somebody came in at that point and wrote an offer. Now, early January, there are buyers circling, but they're not a lot. Mm-hmm. If this home had been listed in April, it would see a lot more activity.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? But January, the first week of January, the early birds are ready. And the smart ones don't want to write an offer the first few days because, especially if they also have time, right? Like if this is somebody that's an early bird and is giving themselves 6 months to find the right house, they don't want to pay full list.
They're not feeling
so they waited 19 days. Yeah, they waited 19 days. It was still available. They wrote an offer and then negotiated it down to 2.305, which is 1.9% below the list price and straight up the fairway for a not stale listing, but a listing that's not in its first honeymoon weekend, right? The honeymoon period is the first 7 to 10 days. Mm-hmm. So you pass the honeymoon period and it's and 1.9% is perfectly reasonable and expected as a discount that's negotiated between buyer and seller. So this is like,
do we want to call it like poster child?
No, I mean, I keep using the golf term straight up the fairway. Like it's just when you take, if you were to take the average sale price of listings that are brand new, right? That they're going to sell for list or over in the average for sure. And the median too. But if you were to look at listings that are between 2 weeks and maybe 6 weeks old, they're going to be in that 1 to 3%. Mm-hmm. Even up to 2 months, 1 to 3% is going to be somewhere is the median. But if you're going to look at listings that are older than 2 months, it's more like 3 to 5%. Yeah. And that can go two months to, you know, 8 months, 10 months before sellers finally get the message. And if it's the fourth quarter, we've been successful well exceeding 5% in negotiated discounts because the seller at that point is just ready to capitulate.
Tired of it.
I mean, I've negotiated 11% discounts in the fourth quarter. I'm not saying that's likely, but it's possible.
So it's interesting. I actually went and checked this one out for some clients of ours. They requested to see it. I was able to get out there the next day and get them the video. It's the same day I took it. And the house showed very well. One of the things that I personally enjoyed the most out of it was the like wraparound bench around the fireplace in the main area, main room. That was awesome. And the seller's agent was also really communicative as far as like water damage and things. Our buyers have a sensitivity to moisture and, you know, subsequently mold. So they were able to disclose a lot of details with that. And I mean, we haven't necessarily advertised the service in a little bit. And for some reason, I'm in a plugging mood. But, you know, we get out there and this is a 50-minute long video walking through every detail of the house, every, you know, potentially deferred piece of maintenance or defect that I could find. It's not just a rainbows and sunshine. You get that on the listing online. We'll go there and try and figure out the full story.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome, Hamish. I didn't even know until right now that you had done that for our clients. And I don't know if this is a plug. It's just an explanation of what we do.
Yeah.
So if you the are best type of a plug. Client and you have to be under buyer agency, like we may do it once or twice just to show mm-hmm. you before you agree to work with us or before we agree to work with you. And you should test drive your agent before you sign an exclusive. But after we've done this a couple of times and established a working relationship, we're going to ask you for an exclusive to continue to do this because this is not like anything I've seen any other agent do. And Hamish, I don't know if you caught it, he said 50 minutes, 5-0. Yeah. It is not a 3 to 5 minute sales video. This is a video where we are walking slowly through the house and narrating what we see that's right and what we see that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it is detailed.
Oh yeah.
And we often see things that are not disclosed on the SPD. There was a listing for the same client we did in October, November, where literally it looks like massive termite damage and mold damage in the basement. None of that's on the SPD. And we found it in our walkthrough. And I pointed to the fact that that particular house had negative drainage, negative grading toward the foundation and was in a flood zone, and wow. That was probably the reason it was so lush and green outside, including moss growing everywhere, which we're in Colorado.
Unusual, people. Yeah.
If you see moss growing everywhere and it's verdant and green, that's a problem. Maybe it's just a misdirected sprinkler, but this was all the way around the foundation like that. And so they passed on that house. But the point I'm trying to make is what Hamish just shared is something that we do offer. It is primarily for relocation clients. It's also for clients that are just not available. They're traveling mm-hmm. for the weekend. They have a business trip. And a listing pops up, let's say on a Thursday. And it's exciting. We schedule a phone call. And we go through that listing to make sure it's a good fit. Because devoting this much time and resources to a home that is obviously in a bad location or there's some other fault that's not going to work, we can usually eliminate half of the houses that our clients want to see before we even do this video.
Yeah.
And if they want the video, then we go. We schedule the first available showing. We go look at the house. And again, it's 45 minutes to an hour long video is typical. And we talk about the pros and the cons. And then we try to get you that video. I often tell our clients 48 hours.
Yeah.
And that's about setting expectations. Yeah. Because if we're super busy in the summer, it might be 48 hours. But we really put this on the hot burner because attractive homes are so hard to find. We get you that video, we send you a link on YouTube, and we go through the house. And then if that house is exciting for some of our clients, we've actually written offers and negotiated deals and put them under contract, allowing the buyer time to fly in, and mm-hmm. we strongly recommend they do so for inspection. I close at least two houses like this a year now, and I've had a couple of people not even fly in for the inspection, which makes me so uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't like it, but they've done that. And they never complained about it because we found it. Because the video is completely different than a sales video.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you negotiating on a house and putting it under contract and discovering when you fly in.
Could you imagine? Some critical
you miss the fact there's a giant parking lot in the back,
yeah.
or there's a yellow line street up front, or the neighbor is a hoarder and their backyard's full of junk. How did we miss this?
Mm-hmm. And right? Thanks, dude. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Like, now we're under contract. I flew in. I paid for an inspection. I've wasted a lot of time, too. Mm-hmm. And that's a horrible thing.
It's really fun making these videos. And then, you know, it's a private video on YouTube, but you can watch the view count go up. So I'll send it out, and it's like zero views. And then the next day, it's 3. And then the day after that, it's like 12. And for some particular clients, I think they closed last year. They got up to like 15 and continued watching it even while they were under contract and just,
yeah.
you know, built that
excitement.
They're
watching it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're sharing it with their friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't put these videos online for the public to consume because this is a private seller's home that we're videoing and it's not for public consumption. In theory, once our clients either own it or the home is transferred, we could share them. But even then, I'm a little bit hesitant because
it's a little uncomfy.
It feels uncomfortable, like we might be violating someone's sense of privacy. Mm. But if the people sold the house, they no longer own the house. So whose privacy are we violating? But still, it's a little bit questionable. So if you want to see examples of these videos, we can send you a private link and ask you, of course, not to put that anywhere on social media. But that will give you an example of what these videos look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. I think it's time for us to move on, Hamish. We've talked about this house and our videography services for a long time. So let's move on to the news.
All right, fine.
Yeah. They are worth talking about, but I don't want our podcast to be one giant sales pitch for what we do.
This is a good one.
That is not in line with how I roll. People can decide whether they want to use us or not, but ultimately we do, you know, every now and then we'll throw out a call to action and consider reaching out to us.
Absolutely.
All right. Shall we talk about this first news item?
Please do.
Well, you put it on there, but I'll read the news.
Okay, shoot.
I'll read the news and then you can talk about it because these were some of your choices. So Boulder Fire Rescue extinguishes half-acre fire on Second Flatiron in Chautauqua. So a couple of nights ago, late at night, they got the call at 7:43.
Yeah.
There's a fire right at the base of the Second Flatiron. And fire teams got in there, and this is Saturday night, by the way, and they got it contained by 1:30 in the morning on Sunday, right before a really serious wind event started to come into town. So,
yeah.
It's been 20 firefighters.
Absurdly windy. 25 firefighters. This is, I didn't hear anything about this until today when I was like, oh, what's in the news? Very surprising. I was hiking Chautauqua Saturday morning. I was like, did I bring anything inflammatory on, you know, with me? And I was like checking the date, the time and everything. Nope, I'm good. But you know, after...
What possible thing could you have brought, you know, that would be inflammatory?
You have to ask, even if it, even if you had nothing on you, right? You know, it's like going through airport security.
Okay. Just, I mean, it's okay with me if you were smoking something up there. I'm just curious. Just, no. All right.
So, it's like airport security, you know? You go through and you're like, oh, Lord, if, you know. when did we have the... is it the NCAR fire, I think, was the last one really in the foothills we had? Do you know when that one was? I could Google it.
I think Cowood might have been after that, but certainly Marshall was after that.
Was?
I think it doesn't really matter. Yeah. The point is that there's lots of fires.
Yeah, that's where we're
getting. And fire risk is a really big deal. And it's not just a big deal for the mountains, like where my home is. I live about a 15 to 20 minute drive from downtown Boulder. It's a risk for everybody. Mm. But historically, we've only thought about that risk for homes in the mountains or in the foothills. And when the Marshall Fire happened and, you know, destroyed an insane number of houses in Superior and Louisville, suddenly people started thinking about it differently. And in the Dakota Ridge video that we linked earlier, that is actually one of the biggest concerns I have for Dakota Ridge, that that neighborhood has open space on three sides. And
double-edged sword.
It would be very easy for somebody who is driving along US 36 to Lyons to flick a cigarette butt out the window and set it on fire, which has already happened, by the way.
For Dakota Ridge, North Boulder?
Dakota Ridge didn't burn, but there was a fire that burned a whole bunch of... multiple times. That area north of Dakota Ridge on the west side of Broadway has caught fire. And I think it's largely from people discarding cigarettes out the window, but who knows what's causing those fires. So Boulder is very on edge about fire risk. And it is something everyone should think about when you buy a home or if you already own a home here in Colorado, because we live in a very dry climate and wind conditions can sometimes be very high. And if it's dry and windy, your home may be at risk of fire. And so people pay a lot of attention to this, and you should too. And insurability mm-hmm. is an issue too. So when we look at homes, we, especially in the mountains, but elsewhere, fire mitigation is something that we talk about with our buyers, and it's something you should be thinking about. And you should also be double-checking your insurance costs before closing, and with the knowledge that it could go up and it could be a challenge to find insurance going forward.
It's also something I think we're continuing to learn more about. A couple of weeks ago, we went to the National Forest Service demonstration on pile burns and mitigation for up in the mountains, kind of where you live. And, you know, it's kind of intuitive how fire mitigation and everything works, but I know that we both walked away having learned something. It's in a prior podcast. I'll go ahead and link it in the show notes. But, I'd say more and more frequently top of mind, or in the back of the mind at least. And now driving into 36, you do see a little bit of a burn scar, which is, it's sad to see.
Yeah, it's sad to see. And at the same time, fire is a natural part of this habitat, and all of the efforts to prevent fire just has increased combustible fuels. So it's a recipe for wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot by having wildfire partners come out and certify my house. There were things I just wouldn't have expected to be an issue. And that included things like the floor mat material on our entryways. It included flashing around our shed to make sure it was low enough so embers that are blowing don't go under the shed.
Mm.
And even though our house is clad in hardy board, which is a cement board and has a metal roof, it could still easily burn. So there's all this stuff we do to try to mitigate fire risk, and that there's all this stuff you can learn from professional organizations that can advise you on reducing fire risk. But it would be helpful if your agent also gave you some advice before you even got that far. And if you're thinking about selling, same thing. You really should do the fire mitigation in advance and get it certified, mm-hmm. because that will help sell your home.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, sucks, next news item. To see. Ready?
Yep. Go for it.
All right. So this is in Fox News, Hamish. I didn't know you paid attention to Fox News, but I saw it elsewhere too. And that the news item is that
when it's local, Boulder, it's a little better.
Yeah, Boulder. It's starting to play a video, so I hope this doesn't disrupt the sound.
No, you're still good.
Turn off. that source and switch to a different one. The actual article is from U.S. News and World Report, so we should probably link to that one, Hamish, not the Fox News article about it.
Yeah.
And basically, this is a list of the best places to live for quality of life, and they ranked Boulder as number 2.
Yay.
In the nation. We're number 2.
Yes.
And I guess I love living here in Boulder. It is I moved here in 2000 and I moved away, and within 3 months I regretted it. The quality of life difference. At the time I moved to New York City and I eventually found work in investment banking, and it just didn't matter. The quality of life difference was so extreme. The happiness level was so extreme between here and Manhattan. And even though I was working in the field I wanted to work in, and I now have, you know, all the skills I built and all the years I worked in the investment world, I still, at that moment, I just felt in my gut I made such a big mistake. My happiness level plummeted.
Mm-hmm.
And Colorado in general, and Boulder in particular, is an amazing place. I used to regularly publish all of the awards that Boulder would win year after year.
Oh, yeah.
Until the chorus of voices that I kept hearing about, oh, now even more people are going to want to move here. Like, the people that live here hate these articles.
Oh, yeah. It's like, I'm almost glad we're number 2. And I clicked on the real article, and now it's saying number 4. So, some ambiguity.
Oh, I still see number 2 when I'm on the U.S. News and World Report.
Weird.
Number 2, best places to live for quality of life. An overall score of 6.8.
Either way.
And quality of life was 7.7, yeah.
If we're not number 1, we're at least slightly shaded from the limelight. So, you know.
Yeah.
Something.
Well, they gave Ann Arbor, Michigan, the number 1 for quality of life. And, I mean, of course, if housing affordability, we're not even going to be close.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's a little pull-down menus. There's population size filters. You know, this is interesting and sort of armchair dreaming about where you want to live.
Definitely one of those websites, right?
Yeah, it's one of those websites.
It would be a magazine on a dentist coffee table 2 decades ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, look, my school ranks number 3 in the nation, but subset of small schools in the Northeast, subset of schools that specialize in these things. I'm like, okay, based on what? I love Colorado. I love Boulder. Everyone knows it's an amazing place to live. Most people that leave here regret it. And want to move back, including me. And that's called, have you heard this, Hamish? Niwot's Curse?
No.
Oh.
Yeah, this is new.
So, Niwot, Chief Niwot, and I'm. This is dangerous territory because we did not prep for this. and I don't like to
I'll
talk
make
about
a time
things
code mark. Yep.
Well, no, you don't need to. You don't need to. I just need to say that this is based on my limited understanding of this subject of Chief Niwot. Okay, I don't. Like, there's a statue of the guy, and I've heard about this, and that's all I know. And okay. The curse is that he cursed the people that move here that they will have to keep coming back. Anybody that visits must keep coming back. If you ever leave from Boulder, you will be forced to come back. You cannot stay away from Boulder.
I like that. That's, I mean, based in reality or not, it's a cute sentiment. I like that a lot.
When I moved away and I found out how many people have connections to Boulder, it's like there are these energy currents that run around the world. And there are certain places, like this city is 100,000 people, yet it gets mentioned over and over again in all sorts of news articles. There's so many people that are from here or who have lived here who talk about it, including some incredibly popular people that have some connection to Boulder.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Elon's brother could live anywhere in the world. Where does he live? Where does he live?
There it is.
No, and he's not even the only really wealthy person that's here. There's lots of wealthy, successful people here.
It's I'm from New Zealand. I'm sure we've touched on that beforehand, but we always joke, you know, like everybody knows somebody from New Zealand because we like get out there and travel and stuff. But it feels like the same type of deal from in Boulder. You know, Boulder's small, kind of compact, a little bit tucked away, but makes itself known, and for good reasons. Yeah.
All right, I think we've touched on how great we are.
Lots of patting ourselves on the back on this one.
this next news piece, I don't know if this is legit news, Hamish. You found this, and it's interesting, but the source is Mile High Commercial Real Estate, which
that one, okay,
is so congratulatory or self interested that I wonder if it truly is true, but certainly. Well, let me read you the article. Denver Boulder
among the top... I'll vet the website. You read it.
And it's top preforming life science markets. So this is the other reason I think this article is BS, is that they can't spell performing right. Mm. Like, was it written by...
a British person?
Or are we preforming into a life science market? Do you see it? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, like that's the headline on this article. So no offense, Mile High Commercial Real Estate, but you kind of want to get your title of the article right. But they're saying more than a half billion square feet of tenant demand, record levels of VC, NIH funding, which I thought NIH was... Now maybe I'm confused with the European one, but are positioning Denver...
Oh, yeah,
you're
thinking about Britain's...
The UK Institute. Yeah. Isn't that NIH? Anyway, are positioning Denver Boulder among the top-performing life science real estate markets, NHL. According to a new report from CBRE. 14 companies are currently seeking half a million square feet of lab space across the Denver Boulder market, including Aurora. And the region was one of only three among 13 largest life science markets in the U.S. to see tenant demand increase in the fourth quarter of 2023. So,
I know why it's performing. Thing that,
what's that?
It's preforming because the editor is from England.
Really?
Yeah. That's why.
That's how you spell performing in England?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just feeling very doubtful, so. But I'm gonna believe you. Because how that makes way more sense than they somehow missed, you know, this commercial real estate firm somehow missed that word. But okay.
Yeah.
All right. Fine.
Sorry
fine.
To detract. Carry on.
That's okay. And they're talking about, you know, there's a lot of data in this article about the funding that's been going in from venture capital. And years ago, I wrote an article on our blog that talked about the virtuous cycle of entrepreneurship here in Boulder County. And what happens is that there's a tech startup that blows up that does incredibly well, like Storage Tech, and then it spins off a dozen or more other startups.
Mm.
Because once there's a liquidity event and an exit, the executives make a lot of money, and then they want to go do it again, particularly with the people they liked working with. And so you'll see this virtuous cycle spin up, and it's not just in tech. So when I was first moved here in 2000, it was the dot-com bubble, the last year of the bubble, and it was all dot-coms, right? All mostly retail dot-com companies that were getting funding, and it was a zoo. But since that time, when I moved back in 2005, it became pretty apparent to me that it's not just so-called tech companies. There is life science companies, there's defense companies, and then there's also a really healthy academic university research environment, including federal labs that are not academic, that are also counter-cyclical to a normal recession. So our region has had a diversity of businesses for quite a while, and prior to 2000, the economy here was closely tied to oil and gas. So there were massive boom and bust cycles. I attended a state demographer presentation in 2005 or 2006, this Colorado state demographer, and she walked the audience through this. And I remember it being a she, but I could be mistaken. And what she said was that until 2000, people left the state during a bust. But after 2000, they stayed. So even though there was a recession after the dot-com bubble, people stayed here. They figured out how to make it work, and they found work in other industries, obviously. And other industries continue to grow and diversify. And so your idea was that it's, you know, first it was tech and now life science, but I'm just going to counteract that. No, actually, it's kind of a gradual... Go ahead.
No, I was going to just say it's kind of been like this. Is that what you're saying? Or getting to? Or
I think it's getting better. I think our regional economy has gotten more diverse and more resilient for the last 20 years. I think it's been getting better on the Front Range. The Western Slope is a very different animal.
Oh, yep. Don't know the Western Slope. Worth anything. I mean,
it is radically different, and which is why I'm comfortable doing the resort markets in my personal brokerage practice, in my real estate practice, where I understand those markets to some extent, particularly given my past work in resort markets on Nantucket. But I do not feel comfortable on the Western Slope. The dynamic on the Western Slope is so different. And my friends out there tell me what's going on. It's like another planet compared to the Front Range.
Yeah. I think I've only ever been to the Western Slope in passing, really, on my end.
But. It's beautiful, but different. Well, it's just that the supply and demand factors are just so radically different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even feel comfortable enough to go buy investment property on the Western Slope. Let me share that, right? Like, and this is my business.
And it's investing in what I wouldn't buy, right? That's the...
I don't feel like I know enough.
Yeah.
And I would be very worried that the job market could collapse on the Western Slope, unlike the Front Range. I don't think the Front Range is in any danger of wholesale job loss.
And you hit on this too. Man, it really is a go Boulder, go this area. But, you know, the CU's there. There's government-run laboratories. There's a lot there that kind of hedges against recessions too.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the education bubble is going to burst. There's increasing signs that that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about forever the Front Range. I just think for the next 3 years, I have a hard time visualizing, you know, massive job loss resulting in all these people moving to some other place, thereby real estate values come down, because real estate values in the primary market, which is the Front Range, are closely tied to employment. And real estate markets that are in the resort markets tend to track along with the stock market. Those are not tied to primary. Those are secondary home markets.
Big boy toys.
Yeah. Someday. We'll get there.
Okay.
Although, well, all right. Enough about that topic. Let's move on. It's a great article.
Gives us room to talk on another episode.
Yeah. And Boulder has a lot of tech companies now. I mean, Google's here. Apple's here. Twitter's here. And lots of others are here. We have a concentration of educational talent, creative talent, financial resources, and most importantly, an amazing place to live. Like, they move here to be close to the trails. Mm-hmm. They move here to be on the cycling routes. They move here so they can go skiing in a couple of hours.
Pretty sweet.
All right. Let's talk about the airport.
Yeah, you wanted this one to be its own kind of almost a special episode, right?
It's a big topic.
There's a lot that we could get. I mean, we could go super into the nitty-gritty. How about we do an overview, you know, just right. What the we'll thing says, and yeah,
we'll keep it simple. And I'll start with the article. I mean, I could talk about a little summary beforehand, but we'll start with the article. And this is from AV Web. I think it's an aviation web, because their logo web has a plane in it.
Yeah.
Okay. And this article, I think, actually did a really good job. Amelia Walsh is the author. And they are saying that a campaign to decommission the airport, and they give the call sign KBDU, in favor of new mixed-use neighborhood has been circulating online. And the petition wants to turn this 179 acres of land into housing that would better serve the community. Mixed-use, they say, rather than a small hobbyist airport for some 200 people who own or fly private aircraft. And so the issue, of course, is that the FAA has been funding this airport for many years, and they would have to release Boulder from its obligations in order to develop it into something else.
Mm.
And so this issue has been gradually gaining steam, Hamish. The first time I heard it was maybe 2 years ago, and I was kind of astounded, but I shouldn't have been surprised, because it's such a large area of land, and there's such an intense need or desire of people to live here. And at the same time, that, in my opinion, just because people want to live here doesn't mean they can. I want to live in Manhattan. I wanted to live in Manhattan in my 20s. I didn't after that, but I did in my 20s, and I couldn't afford it. I had to live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Okay, that's reality. I would have loved a place on Central Park West with a view of the park, and I still can't afford that.
No.
So... right, that's reality. We live within our means. That's my perspective on this. But I get it. We need more housing. People want to live here. And they're looking at this 180 acres of land as an opportunity with some challenges to overcome, known as the FAA. and also, these, if it's 200, maybe it's more than 200 private pilots that utilize the airport. And also, the airport functions as a staging ground to fight wildfire.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah. It can get into the weeds, you know.
Oh, oh, people get really animated. And of course, there's some neighbors that would love to see this airport go away because they don't like the airplanes flying overhead.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like the sound of the planes taking off and landing. And they also point to lead-based fuels, right? Leaded fuels as a legit health concern.
Yeah.
I think they're right. It is a legit health concern. And my dad was a private pilot. My ex was a private pilot. I was working on, well, I was thinking about and excited about getting my license about a decade ago. I decided to focus on a few other things. And I love flying in small planes. I think it's magical. And, you know, the idea of getting into a little bush, a Kit Fox or something like that, a little bush plane, and flying into the wilderness and landing somewhere. And
you've seen those videos where they take off in like 20 feet.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Like there's a YouTuber named Trent Palmer. I'm totally addicted to his content. At least I used to be. I think it would be amazing to fly so easily, but I get where people are coming from. It's going to be an uphill battle, and it's a battle that I wonder if the airport proponents, those that want to keep it an airport, are going to lose just based on how few of those people there are and how many people want to see more housing. And the other area, by the way, is called the planning reserve. So if you are strategically thinking...
Nice.
Yep. If you're strategically thinking about, all right, where is the big developments going to go in Boulder, relatively big developments, none of these are actually that big, the planning reserve, I think, is a much more likely candidate because this is an area that's been designated for more housing for, I mean... decades that this has been targeted. So
it's like you've got your hierarchy of like feasibility and what's next of the domino to be developed, right? I think this is still quite a ways away.
Well, there's less fighting over the planning reserve, although there will be fighting over that too, because people don't want to. There are lots of people that don't want any more housing.
I mean, CU South even has an issue.
well, look, there's a lot of people that feel Boulder's full, and I don't necessarily disagree. I sympathize with them, but I'm a believer in democracy more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And if the voters, not being hoodwinked, right? If the voters actually want something and have gotten all their heads around the facts and vote for more housing, then that's what we should get, because I'm a 100% believer in democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the planning reserve is the most likely target. And we saw a property last year. I don't know if you were with me, Hamish. I think you might have been. I wrote about it. It was a property in the planning reserve, decent acreage, horrible rundown house with likely unpermitted dwellings or other issues that they were renting out. And the price was a little high.
I remember this one.
And it was a land bank deal, right? This is where you know the cash flow is not there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not buying it for the cash flow. You're buying it to put your $1.2 million or whatever it was to just sit there and park that cash, because this will 100% get developed. It's money in the bank for sure, and that million could be a $4 million parcel in 10 years as the opportunities to develop shrink and shrink. But there's still regulatory risk with that investment. There is still a chance that the neighbors fight it and are successful. I think the writing's on the wall. I wrote about this in the newsletter. I think the pendulum has swung, and our elected officials, like it or not, are going to keep opening the door for more development.
Yeah. I just hope it's under pressure. Well thought out. You know, that said it all.
I look at what they've built so far.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we feel like Boulder Junction is well thought out? Do we feel like this postmodernist stuff looks good?
Oh,
I don't
man.
Think so. It has metal trees. Okay. The rail station they put in the middle of that of Boulder Junction looks lovely,
mm-hmm.
but that's an original rail station. I think it was owned by the JCs for a while.
Oh, wow.
They moved it to that location. That looks lovely. But the other stuff around it is like, it's just high density, ugly housing. And people have a right to live where they want to. Well, they have a right to.
Well, you're good. We've hit that note. We're fine there.
Yeah, let's stop. Yep. Do they have a right to housing or not? That's a whole nother topic. And we should stop. Yeah. I almost said that, but
no,
I'm not even sure
that.
I believe that.
Yada, yada, yada. The whole airport thing came to mind. I saw a friend of mine. He's a prolific flyer. Like, he'll paraglide. I think he's flown quite a few, like, fighter jets. Military history? Interesting guy. Kind of like your Top Gun friend. And he was sharing the petition to save the airport. So I was like, well, let's cover it. Let's at least chat about it in the... in the podcast. And I'm sure we'll go into it more in depth if it ever develops. Though for now, it's just, you know, it's being pitched as a thought. And maybe we'll jump into the... There's just airport controversy everywhere. The Jefferson County Airport is constantly under fire from Superior residents because the flight path is right over it. So, yeah, just putting that in the listeners' minds, your guys' minds.
I mean,
minds.
In my mind, look, I strongly... Well, first, thanks for shout out to my Top Gun friend, yeah. Codenamed GI, one of my favorite people. And I really enjoyed working with him. But yeah, I kind of feel like you knew what you were getting into when you bought these properties. And if you're surprised there's an airplane, you're on the flight path, you didn't do your due diligence. And these airports have been here for decades. So it's sort of like the neighbor complaining that they lost their view because the other neighbor developed a house that was well within code and regulations. They've done nothing wrong. And you're angry and suing them because you lost your view. That you didn't buy your view, you didn't have a right to your view, and the regulations can change over what can be built over time. So I think people should advocate 100%, but I also think sometimes it gets a little silly when people are advocating for, I don't know, for things that have been here for such a long time, and, yeah. and you don't personally get the benefit of it, so you don't see the benefit. I mean, if they're staging for wildfire at these airports, which they do, you will directly get the benefit of your home potentially not burning down. And it's
and that's a huge add to have a staging zone for wildfire mitigation. You know, that, you brought that up and I was like, oh, well, okay. My opinion's kind of been cemented. But
Broomfield also now has a carrier that is chartering flights.
Oh, yeah.
So like, yeah. And you can skip the whole TSA thing and go right on board. It's really fast. Mm-hmm. They still do some preliminary screening, I'm sure, but it's like a quick flights to Vegas, and I think it also goes somewhere in California.
Colorado Springs. quickest flight ever.
Yeah, I mean, people love that as a service, and it's actually pretty reasonably priced, mm-hmm. Flying right out of Broomfield. So, I don't know. It's an interesting project to watch, to a debacle that's unfolding, and we'll see what happens. We'll see if it may come down to the FAA.
This is true. So, well, what's going on elsewhere outside of the news?
All right, this is this is our segment that we like to call "Tell Me Something I Don't Know." Off of the snarky comments of Gordon Gekko in a movie called Wall Street. And this is hopefully the information that you're not getting anywhere else. And so let me give you a little bit of backdrop to this before we launch into what this is. Many of my clients, particularly those of Asian identity, have moved here and have commented that they haven't found much community. And that was one of the problems they feel exists here in Colorado, that Colorado doesn't have a lot of diversity. And my response for many years is, well, we actually have a lot of diversity. It's not always skin color diversity. A lot of people may be Hispanic in origin that look like they're not. And you also have no idea what their lifestyles are like. And I can tell you some of these people are living some very alternative lifestyles here in Boulder.
Welcome
completely
to Boulder,
under the
yep.
radar. Welcome to Boulder. There are some very, very interesting people here doing some very interesting things. And they have very diverse ideas. And the most oppressed group might be the conservatives here in Boulder that are afraid to talk about their conservative values and ideas. So there's a lot of diversity that just isn't readily apparent. But that seemed to be kind of falling flat. And I realized that what's missing for me personally in my friendship circles was a group that are of Indian origin. And there's a diaspora of people from the subcontinent of India, which includes Pakistan and Bangladesh and, of course, India and Sri Lanka and to some extent Nepal and Tibet. There's a lot of Nepali and Tibetan people here. And so there isn't, from my knowledge, a non-religious, secular group of people that just get together to do fun things. And when I lived in Boston, there was a network of South Asian professionals, NetSAP, and we used to go for hikes and all sorts of adventures. And I'm like, you know, that would be fun to help create that. So taking a page from Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. I think that's Gandhi. It might have been MLK, but similar ideas from both of
profound
those.
Profound enough.
profound enough, I said, let me just start to create this. I want to have a group of friends. I would like to have a little bit more ethnic diversity in my friendship circles and certainly connect with more people of my heritage and background, but I don't want that to be in a church or a mosque or a gurdwara or a temple or a synagogue. I want that to be hiking and then having really good Indian food. Like, that's my vision, and I'd like to go camping with these people and do some cultural things. And I don't want the segregation and mess from South Asia coming here with respect to how these people are different, right? I don't want to focus on the differences because the similarities are profound in culture and language and food. And so I created it. And that group meets about once a month. It's called, euphemistically, the Boulder Brownie Club. And it's open to anybody, but it primarily attracts people that are of Desi or Asian subcontinent origin. And there was a call for a movie night. And so this is Tell You Something You Don't Know. One, this club exists.
Yep.
And two, I'm heavily involved in it. And three, there's an event coming up on Monday that net dovetails with my with the board I'm on. I'm on the board of the Dairy Arts Center right here in Boulder. And I got with the executive director and discussed this idea of having a regular movie night. And she loved it, and much to my surprise, really, you know, got fired up about it.
Really?
And within a couple of weeks, we figured out how to do a Bollywood movie night. And of course, the Dairy is really busy, okay? It has events going on almost every night of the week. But Mondays were generally available for us to use a legit theater. And so this Monday, March 4th, is that right?
Yep.
Look at the calendar for me, Hamish.
Correct. No,
March
5th. 4th? 5th.
March 5th. This Monday, March 5th.
It's March 4th. Yep, I was looking at February.
Okay.
Wow, fantastic.
I've been saying March 4th for a while because, you know, there's that band and you want to March 4th into March. This Monday, March 4th, 2024, at 6 p.m., we're going to be watching a movie called Monsoon Wedding. It's a movie that's about 20 years old. It's by Mira Nair, and it is a phenomenal movie. It is deeply entertaining, and we're going to hang out from 6 to 7 in the lobby, have drinks, have, I think, food from Tandoori. I'm not sure that's confirmed, but that's the plan. We're also working on getting a CU professor to give a short talk after. I don't know if that's happening. I got to check on that. But if you want to come hang out with me and lots of other people,
too.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I hope you come, Hamish. I'll pay for your ticket if that's a if that's a factor for you. You should come. I think it'll be a lot of fun. And this movie's a lot of fun. And it's a Monday night in Boulder, 6 p.m. at the Dairy. So come in at 6 p.m. You could buy your tickets online in advance. If you become a member of the Dairy, the tickets are heavily discounted. And you can meet me, and I'm happy to chat with you about anything movie-related or real estate-related or Boulder-related. And be the change you want to see in the world. If you want to celebrate diversity and connect with people and watch this really fun movie on Monday night, come join us.
Wicked. I think you sold me. You know, Monday nights are typically fairly slow for me anyhow, so that actually sounds like a great way to spend some time and expand my movie knowledge.
In the real estate business, Monday is often Friday.
Yeah.
Monday feels like our Friday.
It does, and yet we still schedule meetings for ourselves.
We schedule meetings. You want to move this to Tuesday?
No, I'm
okay moving our
you.
Monday meetings to Tuesday. It makes sense.
No.
It makes sense to have Tuesday and Wednesday be heavy with our personal team meetings.
The way our stuff shakes out, it's honestly great that we use the whole week as we do. I think it all makes sense, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I think that's about it for this podcast, and it's time to do a little wrap-up.
That's right. Well, if you made it this far, thank you so much for listening. And if you haven't already, check us out on YouTube and pretty much everywhere else for social media. We stay really active on X, Twitter, Instagram, and then a little bit on Facebook. You can check us out even further. And if you'd like more in-depth market analysis, some fresh listings, I know we alluded to that at the start of the podcast, you can find our newsletter at houseeinstein.com. It's one of the top tabs right there. And ultimately, thank you for listening. We hope to catch you next time.
And we welcome your feedback. If
there's
anything that you would like to share with us about this podcast, ways we can improve it, if you're a past client or a current client or just a friend or somebody we've never met before, you can find my contact information all over houseeinstein.com. And you can even call me directly. I'm happy to hear your thoughts and deeply appreciate the time you invested with us today. And we'll catch you next time.